Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I was supposed to do this interview weeks and weeks and weeks ago. And the day of the interview, I talked to Thomas and he told me that he had COVID-19. I'd never heard of anyone who had COVID-19. This is in the early days of the pandemic. We didn't even know that it was a pandemic at the time. And I chatted with him. I got really worried for him, largely because I got wrapped up in his story. Here's a guy who at a previous company that I don't know that I could relate to this in the US, but he worked at a company that helped squatters squat in abandoned buildings, which we don't have that in the US, companies that help squatters. We have companies maybe that kick out squatters. Anyway, he worked at a company that worked with squatters. He ended up turning it into kind of a startup housing or a startup office. Am I right, Thomas? Office environment for them?
Yeah, basically I build a social network for startups as a lead generator for getting startups to make use of empty office buildings instead of squatters.
And then from there, he goes on to say, you know what, we need a better way for people who are sending referrals to companies like mine to get paid. Now, obviously, that had been around for decades. It's called affiliate programs, where anyone can sign up for your affiliate program. And if they send you a customer or they send you a lead, they get paid. But he said, I just don't like the options that are out there. I'm going to create a better way. And he did create a better way. And he said, you know, I had a company before. There's a lot I didn't like about it. I'm going to change everything. Like, too many founders was a problem. And he'll go into in this interview why too many founders was a problem. So he went in a different direction. Raising money is a problem. He went in a direction of bootstrap. All this stuff that he wished he'd done better. The first company, he got to do better with this company. And the company's been doing really well. I invited him here to talk about how he did it. And then I'd also like to find out a little bit about his experience with this dreaded virus. His name is Thomas Vanderklei. He is the founder of a company called Tapfiliate. It's software that allows you to create and manage your own affiliate program. So anyone can sign up and get paid whenever they take the action that you, whenever the audience they send you takes the action that you want. Basically, really, when they send you a customer, they get paid for doing it. All right. We can do this interview thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first is ClickFunnels. It's the software that you know I use to collect leads, but they also have a podcast called Traffic Secrets. I'm going to pitch you and try to get you to listen to Traffic Secrets. And the second is a software that I use to create a new business for this guy who taught my kids, Drew from the Zoo. The Zoo, well, I'll talk about later why I used HostGator and how I used it. But first, Thomas, good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Finally.
Yeah, man. Hey, tell me, do you know how you got COVID-19?
Yeah. So we went to Austria with a group of 10 guys, and we were at a place called St. Anton, which is in Tyrol. And it has one of the most well-known après-ski bars, and it's called the Mosebeard. And it turned out the whole staff was infected, and we were actually occupying the first apartment away from the Mosebeard with that group. You know, we picked out that place because we wanted to be close to the Mosebeard. So we went there every day, and all 10 of us and everybody else I knew who was also in the area got sick.
Wowee. And for you, what was it like for you when you got it?
Yeah, so we decided to go back a day early because, you know, we heard some stories about, you know, all the impending lockdowns and everything. They had already closed that bar like a couple of days prior, midway during the week. So we had decided to go back one day early, and I'm super happy we did because, first of all, you know, a couple of other friends of mine who were also in the area, they stayed, they got locked in. The other thing is that, you know, we drove home and really like the last hour before we went, it's like a 10-hour drive. Really like the last hour before I got home, I got the chills, and then I got home. I had already talked to my wife because I said, you know, I might have this thing and we need to, you know, isolate. You know, when I got home, I just went into the guest room and, just lay down on the bed, three sheets, clothes on. And,
because you were shivering so much and you were that cold.
Yeah. It's just like, just fever basically.
For how many days did you feel that?
Well, I think the fever only lasted like for maybe day and a half. And then, you know, I felt like I was recovering. I just went back to work on Monday, actually. And I got home on Friday. So I was just ill for the weekend. But then, you know, the shortness of breath started and all these other symptoms. And that's when Wednesday, you know, when you're really short of breath, you feel like you're a little bit outside of yourself. So I felt like, you know, I'm not going to be any fun during any interview.
So when you and I talked, you were having trouble even breathing?
Well, that's maybe a little bit too strongly put, but it's like, imagine just having walked a flight of stairs, a couple of flights of stairs, and it not going. So like normally when you do that, it'll just, you know, it'll get better in like a couple of seconds, but just not getting any better. And that, yeah, that went on for quite some time, but I wasn't like I can't breathe or anything.
So it seems like it's a fairly mild situation for you, right? I was worried that it was going to be much more dire for you.
I'd say so. The thing is that, what's a little bit shitty about it is that, you know, it just goes on and on and on. I'm never sick. I work out like a couple of times a week. I'm in good health. I'm never sick. And, you know, whenever I'm sick is like once every 4 or 5 years, you know, it's just like 2 days and it's gone. But here it just like kept going with symptoms, shortness of breath, still feeling like not yourself and anything. And that was a little bit weird about it. But, you know, all in all, I think it was mild though.
But are you still feeling shortness of breath or any impact from this?
Yeah. Okay. So it's a little bit hard to say. I think so. But to be honest, I haven't been really keeping up with my exercise regime.
So you haven't pushed yourself enough to know, can I still do what I was able to do before I got COVID-19?
Yeah, I can't even go to the gym, you know, so it's really hard to say.
Wow. All right. I'm glad to see that you're doing really well. When you say you went back home, what city are you in right now? Where's home?
Amsterdam.
Amsterdam. You grew up in Amsterdam? Is that where you were a DJ as a kid?
No. I grew up in a place called Zeist, which is by Utrecht, which is like the third largest city. And I went on to study there and I used to DJ. Well, I used to DJ as a kid in my hometown, you know, for school dances and things like that. Or even like some people would hire me for their, you know, their 20th anniversary party or whatever. And then I went on to study in Utrecht, which was pretty close by actually. And then, you know, it was my student job to DJ at bars and things like that.
Getting paid as a kid, as someone who's fairly young to do this. It seems like I'm looking at your past here. Our producers put a bunch of notes together for me from your conversation with them. It seems like you are super entrepreneurial. Can you tell me a little bit about this website that you built and the print company that you put together? What was that?
Yeah. Okay. So bear in mind, this was, I think it's like 13 years ago. It was before, to be honest, I had, you know, any sense of sustainability and how important it is to build sustainable businesses. But we built a free printing service for students. And basically what we did is, we would allow you to send your documents through our website. You can either upload them or email them. And then we have printers on all campuses around the Netherlands. And you have to imagine that the Netherlands is smaller than a state in the US. So we had them around the country, but that's not as big as you might imagine. And then you could go to these printers, you'd log in with your username and password on the little screen, and you could print your document. And what we would do is, first, we, you know, scale down your document a little bit, and then we would check, hey, you know, it's Andrew, he studied economics or whatever, and then we would print like a job posting for a bank or whatever, or someone interested in your profile, and we would like print your name in the ad. So we'd say like, hey, Andrew, are you, you know, our next bright shining star? Come work with us.
So I would ask for something to be printed. You would print it to me for free, for gratis, and then you'd also include an ad that was targeted towards me and even included my name in it.
Exactly.
This is it's called Gratis Print. Am I right?
Yeah, free print.
And I'm sorry?
Yeah, that means free print.
Free print.
Gratis is free in Dutch.
What kind of things did people want printed?
So it was mostly like bulk material that they use for studying. So that was also, you know, that was also the why it was pretty effective, because, you know, people would have these things they needed for college and they would be like studying the page, actively looking for a distraction, but, you know, spending actual time on that page where those ads were. So it was a pretty cool way of, you know, having the, you know, the dynamic possibilities of online, but then on paper, actually.
Clever idea. We're talking about 2008 to 2012 is when you were doing this. Obviously, people had laptops at that period, but there are many people who prefer paper when they're reading long form material. Got it. And so you got that. How did you get customers?
Yeah, so we did sales. It was not my problem. Yeah, so we were four guys. We started out three of us. One of my friends, he's like the real commercial guy. We were friends, by the way. Still are. One of my friends is more of the commercial guy. I was more, on the technical side of things. I didn't do any programming back then, but I was more, I understood how these things work. I was more like in a product management kind of role. And then I had a third friend, and he was our financial guy. And we went on to acquire, I'd say, this other company who was doing the same thing. And we were more like marketing guys, and they were like four tech guys. We acquired that company and just took one of the guys, and he was our main developer.
So how'd you get customers? And by the way, for anyone listening, he was in his teens at the time, right? Thomas, we're talking about a teenager doing this.
I thought it was 19, I think.
So how'd you get customers?
Yeah, so basically just cold calling, reaching out.
That's for the businesses who are paying for ads. You were calling them and said, I have these college students. I can target ads for you. It wasn't an affiliate deal. It was just straight up, they pay you per print.
Okay, well, so basically, so there's two parts to this. First, we needed, that whole big bunch of students to be able to, show these ads to. And then we needed ads to fill the inventory that created, because everything they printed created ad inventory for us. The students we got through, the universities, they have these introduction weeks, and we would find a sponsor, we get like free yogurts or whatever, and we would hand those out, and we put laptops down and basically force everybody almost to sign up, like with a big team. So that went really well. We built a big database. Then we sold ads to companies where we did cold calling indeed, but we were left with a lot of excess inventory.
Yeah.
Because, we sent emails, we did like narrow casting on the little screen. We had, of course, the ads on the print. We had a lot of rest inventory, and that we filled with affiliate marketing.
Where'd you get the affiliate programs? Commission Junction back then?
No, we used TradeDoubler mostly, and there was a couple of local ones here in the Netherlands. This business was very Netherlands focused.
I could see it's very local. In fact, one of the ways that you were able to save money was you wouldn't mail it to the students. You just say, go pick it up essentially from this printer. You'd give them the location and they would get to print it. They would get to pick it up. Am I right?
Yeah. Actually, yeah. They got to go to the printer and then log in with their username and password. Which was actually very novel back then. I think we like by accident created the first cloud printing system in the Netherlands.
I'm looking at the early version of the site. Yeah, I can see up to 60 pages of notes, and it's largely for student lecture notes that they could print up on location. Where'd you come up with the idea for it?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think we just saw a need. It started out as a student project for the university of my friends. I think we took it from there. I'm not really able to tell, I guess.
Okay. Tell me about this squatting agency. What are the squatting laws where you are?
Yeah. So,
boy, you're starting to get darker and darker and darker as we're talking. There's no light.
I have an idea.
Oh, you do? Let's see what he's got. What time is it in the Netherlands now?
It's 8 p.m.
8 p.m. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so cool. What's the squatting laws in the Netherlands?
Yeah, so squatting used to be legal. It's really, really weird. It's when you have a table, a bed, and a chair, you have something which is called, translates to home peace, which sort of means you live somewhere.
Okay.
Renters are really, really well protected here in the Netherlands. So squatting used to be legal. It's illegal now, but
squatting is where people see an empty building and they go and live there. This, I remember, happened in New York, and this police had to go in and get people out of the building. And there was this whole controversy about how fair it is. If no one's using the building, why can't the homeless live in it? But if the homeless are living in it, who's making sure that they're protected and that they're not stealing electricity and all that stuff? And also ownership rights in the US. So you're saying in the Netherlands at the time, anyone can squat as long as they had a mattress, a table, what was it?
Yeah, and a chair.
A chair. They have that. That means they're allowed to stay indefinitely?
Well, it's really complicated. First of all, squatting is a very politically loaded subject here, because it's not for, mostly not like for homeless people, so to say. It aired on the anarchist sort of like side of things, where okay. people, there's like famous squatters actually, like, Wolf on that, that started. It's very like a socialist slash anarchist thing. I don't know like all that about
it. Got it. But, so it's not that they don't, that they can't find a better place to live. It's just that they have a point of view. Okay. Yeah. And we're talking about roughly what, 2008, the global economic crisis. Am I right about that?
Yeah. So like the political side of things that started out in the 70s. But when I was there, it was because of the economic crisis that, you know, that's why we had all those empty office buildings.
Right. So suddenly people couldn't afford to maintain their office buildings, and squatters said, this is my opportunity in the Netherlands. That was okay. And so what was the company that you worked for doing with that?
Yeah. So basically here in the Netherlands, it's not socially acceptable to board up buildings, and it's just not done. So what we do is we put squatting guards in there, which basically, you know, before used to mean we put someone in such a building to live there for like a very low amount of money, like say, you know, like $100 a month in the center of Amsterdam, on the condition that they will leave within 2 weeks whenever asked. But there's also some interesting side notes to that.
Wait. So if you don't put anything up and the building is empty, anyone can come stay inside. If you board it up, it's not accepted, and it's just not culturally appropriate to do it. So you can't do that. What people would do is office owners or building owners would just have a guard sit there and say, sorry, you can't squat here, and ask people to move on. And
no,
you guys said, let's make peace with them.
It's actually, we call it the squat guard, but it's just the person living there. So the person signs up with the agency where I work, said, hey, you know, I want to live in this cheap housing, and I'm prepared to leave within 2 weeks if you ask me if I can live there cheaply. So that's basically it. So, and we call that squat guards, but it's just people living there. Okay. And the thing that I was doing is, so we got all these empty office buildings in the financial crisis. And it's really hard to use the traditional model to let people live there, because, you know, there's different, you know, fire precautions that you need to take. They need a shower, which, you know, most office buildings don't have. So what we said is, you know, why don't we, especially in this crisis, create an opportunity for these startups to get an office space for really, really cheap. And that's what we did. And then the question was like, okay, we are a traditional agency, and we're known for putting people in these houses to live there. How are we going to, you know, talk to entrepreneurs? And that's when we came up with, you know, we're going to build a social network for startups and use that as a lead generator.
How did you get anyone to join this social network for startups?
So we did a lot of, you know, coffee meetups. We tried to sort of like do a lot of networking, help entrepreneurs wherever we could. And at first it was like a really, you know, hands-on thing where we would, you know, listen, get people in touch with each other, do like manual matchmaking, get them to post content on the website. And then as we developed the website further, you know, we created more opportunities to create user-generated content. And that sort of like went as a flywheel.
The goal was get them into the network and then tell them, if you need office space, we've got this cheap space that's just sitting there.
Yeah. Exactly.
Got it. Okay. And is that where you discovered affiliate programs?
Well, I discovered that in the printing era, of course, because that's where we filled the empty the excess ad space that we had. When I was working at this company, I was on the other side, because we wanted to use, first of all, affiliate marketing to get new members. That wasn't possible because for affiliate networks, it was just, too small. It was peanuts. They weren't interested. Other than that, we also had a lot of these entrepreneurs that came to us that said like, hey, you know, we want to advertise on your website. And then we said, or we want to promote our business, because like you have all these entrepreneurs in your database. I do something that's interesting for entrepreneurs. Like I have these services. That's when we said, okay, yeah, sure. You know, we're open to that, but you know, we are a commercial company. So we got to earn something also important to know that I was sort of like busy, sort of like detaching this social network from the squatting business. I wanted this to be two separate entities, one, you know, being its own business and just, you know, doing, selling leads to the squatting agency. So I was also looking for other ways to earn money. So that's why we said, you know, we got to earn some money if you want to advertise on our network. But then the problem was always that these were all starting companies, so they didn't have, you know, any money to put up upfront. So said, okay, sure, you know, if we can share somehow and whatever you sell, then we're also okay with it. And then we always got stuck at the tracking bit. So that's partly where the idea for Tetfiliate came from.
All right, let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor. I want to tell you a story about this little business that I built for a guy named Drew. And then I want to come back and ask you about some of the difficulties that you had at that period. This was one of the toughest points in your life. A partnership was failing. You were living off your savings. You were watching your friends. I want to ask you about that. But first, check this out. We're now in lockdown. My kids can't go to school. I'm reading them stories at night and talking to them about bugs. And whenever they have a question, I go to Google and I look it up. But at some point, I couldn't figure out the answers to some of their questions. Like, for example, my five-year-old said, what happens if a stinger from a bee is on the ground and I take it and I poke somebody? Which is kind of like a weird thing to say, but I get it. I get the curiosity. He's trying to figure out, is the poker the problem or is what's in it the problem? And is the stuff that the bee injects in you, is that what lives with the poker or lives with the, anyway, couldn't figure out those answers for questions like that. So I went on Twitter and I said, does anybody know an entomologist that I can Zoom with my kids for a few minutes and just ask some questions? And someone said, yeah, I do. Here, this guy, Drew, he works at the San Francisco Zoo. He'd be happy to do it as a favor to me. And sure enough, the guy said, yeah, absolutely. I'll do this Zoom with your kids. And so my kids get on and I ask him if it's okay if I invite some of my kids' friends who they haven't seen in weeks. And he said, sure, the more the better. And so it's about six kids, all about the same age, 3 to 5 years old. And they're pelting him with questions and he's answering all their questions. It turns out, by the way, that a bee stinger can actually contain the, I forget what it's called, the part that will irritate your skin. It's in the stinger. And if it falls off, you can absolutely use it as a weapon, which is not what my kid was asking. But now we have the answer to that. But he also brought on this snake and he showed them how a snake eats. He brought on another snake. He brought on a chameleon. He brought on whatever animals he had in his house, the dogs that were at his foot. And he just kept things interesting and it was fascinating. And at the end, I said, so how are you spending your days? He says, well, the zoo is furloughing all of us. I'm going to get to the business part of this in a moment. He says, I do a little bit of work for them during the day, but for the most part, I have free time. I said, you should do this professionally. He goes, I would love to. I used to teach kids and now I did this and it's so much fun. I said, why don't you just build a site? And he says, well, I guess I should. So I have HostGator as a sponsor. I go, let me go try this. It's been a while since I created a new site on HostGator from scratch. Within minutes, I had this site up and running. I went for their cheapest, if not their second cheapest option. And immediately they gave me all these options for what I could install. I picked WordPress because it was super simple. I was up and running with WordPress. I started getting a little carried away with the different themes and designs. And I said, no, here's all it's going to be. A simple black and white theme. I'll shoot a video of myself saying, here's what happened with my kids when he taught them. And I think you should buy a ticket to the next session that he does. And that's all I did. And then I showed it to him and he said, yeah, that's great. So I emailed my audience and within minutes we sold out this one live session that he's doing. And I said, do you want to do more? He goes, yeah, I want to do more. This is great. He's making more money doing this than he would at the zoo if the zoo was open. All because we recognize that there are a lot of kids like mine who are just sitting at home bored. A lot of parents like me who want to teach their kids and he is super engaging. He's got this ability. And within minutes, I was able to create the site. Believe me, if this took up more time than that, I don't have time for that. I got a business to run. I got kids to take care of. I got a wife who's like feeling like she's being neglected during this COVID, even though we're in the house, she's not spending enough time with me. I don't have time, but I built it up fast. And now he's got this business and I'm excited about it. And he's excited about it. Listen, if you're out there and you're listening to me and you haven't started something yet, you should go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. Even if you have started and you just want to get your creative, look at how excited I am about this. You want to get your creative juices flowing, build something from scratch. and feel free to delete it if it doesn't work out. That's what made this such a fun experience for me. I said, who cares? I'll just try this and try that. And if it doesn't work out, I'll delete the whole thing and start over or not start over. Who cares? It's the fun of creation that I got to tap back into. If you go to hostgator.com/Mixergy, like I did, you will get the lowest price they have available, like I got. And also you're going to have an easy experience with them. They make it super simple to get started with them. And then of course, if you hate your hosting company or you just want to save some money, do what I did with my other site, which is switch it over to HostGator. In fact, I didn't do that myself. I just asked Michael. I said, Michael, switch over anything that we don't have on HostGator over to HostGator. Let's save some money. We save money. So brand new site, take to HostGator. A site that exists and you want to save money, take it to HostGator. And if you go to hostgator.com/Mixergy, you will get the lowest price they have available. That's hostgator.com/Mixergy. Thomas, tell me a little bit about the bad things that were going on. When you told our producer, look, I had a partnership that was failing, what do you mean? Who's the partnership with?
With another friend that joined the company, you know, a couple of months in. He is a fantastic guy, very talented. He lives in the US now, by the way, but very talented guy. And, you know, we were working on the company. He was helping out with the marketing bit of things. But he's more of a salesman, you know, great at making connections with people, that sort of thing. But we were, a starting tech company, with a product that sold back then at $29 a month. So it's not really worth, you know, picking up the phone for, or, you know, doing any sales like that.
Oh, so this wasn't even at the printing company. We're talking about Tapfiliate. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah,
so oh, then let me wait with that. Let me ask you this then. You knew about Tapfiliate software. Why create Tapfiliate? We'll get into the problem with your partnership. Then why create Tapfiliate? I don't understand. The reason that I don't understand is there's tons of apps out there that do what, there's tons of software out there that do what you do. Why did you feel like you had to create something brand new? Why couldn't you just stick with one of the ones that existed?
Well, I think the ones that existed, you know, they were back then, like really 1990s solutions. I think, yeah, you know, that there wasn't one that had, you know, what I was looking for. You know, the thing is you onboard partners on this platform. So it's really important that, you know, it feels and looks and does, and is up to the standard.
I mean, the affiliates who are sending you business are their first professional experience with you could be when they sign up for this affiliate program on your site.
Exactly.
I get it. Let me take a moment. You're absolutely right. This is not just me blowing smoke when I say to you, your stuff just looks way better than the competition that I'd seen. I get that, especially the older players who were around when you got started, they look clunky. They were in the 90s still, it felt like. But why create a whole new thing? Did you see a business opportunity? Did you say, look, we're going to see more businesses coming online, more of them are willing to take on affiliates, and they won't relate to the old world? Is that what it was? It was not so much that you had a problem that you couldn't find a better solution for. It was just that you said, this thing that exists needs to be modernized. They're not going to do it because they're stuck in their old legacy ways. I'm going to be the one to create a new version of it?
Yeah, basically.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought, you know, this is just something that needs improving. You know, I think affiliate marketing can be a really, really wonderful way of doing marketing where you can really engage partners and where affiliates can add a lot of value in the sales process. So I think, you know, it's a wonderful form of marketing. It has its bad sides as well. And we try to sort of like focus on the really good kind of, affiliate versus advertiser combinations. But it's a beautiful way of doing marketing, I think. And I think it deserves, you know, something better at the point. So I said I had to make that.
You know, where I see your attention to detail is in the URLs. How many affiliate URLs do you see that are insanely long? Amazon is the famous example of that, right? You give an Amazon affiliate link, it's full of a bunch of data. It's functional, not pretty, right? And if it's so functional that I could kind of get a sense of who's using an affiliate program, what the affiliate program is by reading the URL, but it's not pretty. You care to that degree. And that's an example, one of many that I could come up with for what separates Tapfiliate from your competition. Where does that come from? Are you the guy with the aesthetic sensibility, or was it someone else on the team who said, we can make this pretty from the beginning?
Well, the URL would be more my thing, but the actual, you know, aesthetic thing is, in the end, I'm a developer, and our product definitely in the beginning was like sort of like built by a developer for developers. So it was really, you know, in my opinion, like very well organized, and things were in the right place and things followed the logical structure. But then we got some, you know, some more people that were more marketeers than I am, got on the platform, and they just didn't understand anything about it.
When you say that you wanted to come up with something that was more modern, what are you talking about then? If not this design, if not this online experience?
Yeah. So no, the design, you know, I am not the one making it. In the end, I know what looks nice, and I have.
And so you hired somebody who did it. You partnered up with someone.
Yeah. I hired people who did it.
From beginning. And the reason that you did that instead of partnering up with someone was you had a bad experience before. What was the experience with the print company that was so bad?
Well, you know, we were friends, and we were in that company for equal partners. What I really learned there is that, you know, a ship needs just one captain. We did a lot of, you know, very cool things, but we also ended up, you know, spending so much time, you know, being a little debate club, I'd say.
Like what? What's an example of something that you turned into a debate club instead of having clear leadership?
Yeah, it's you know, bike shedding. It's all minor things, and it's about, you know, it turned into a you know, who has the final say kind of thing, I guess, you know, unwittingly.
Major argument. It's just every little thing could become a debate.
Should we collect phone numbers from the student? Should we or shall we? Yeah, that's a thing, you know, and it's something that we debated for, you know, it's almost days, I guess. And we were like 20, so we didn't really know what we were doing.
Did you have an issue with investors? Am I misunderstanding that?
Yeah, we got into a little bit of a weird situation where we had a bit large printing company. They were sort of like spotting us work capital. So we got their printers and paper and everything, and we didn't pay for it. We were supposed to pay that back at a later point. And then we had investors who invested money in the company, different ones. And at some point, you know, a sort of like power play between these investors and the printing company sort of like started to emerge, where one of the investors came in and he said, well, just let me dictate the email that you will send to them. Again, we were 20, and here was this. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we, you know, we didn't feel right. And then, you know, he sent us on our way with things that we, you know, were supposed to do at that point, in the meeting with the printing company. And we didn't really understand it, but he said, no, this is what you're going to do. This is what you're going to do. And it turned out to be a total farce. And then, like, in the end, we, you know, got back to them and said, you know, yeah, to be honest, this is all getting like out of hand. We like spoke from the heart to them, and that's like solved everything with the printing company.
The other thing you didn't like was there was a constant hunt for new customers. And so you decided this new business is not going to be that. It's going to be software as a service. I see. Let me take you down memory lane for a moment. This is what one of the earliest versions of your site looked like. Look at that. Nice, right?
Awesome.
You look at the smile on your face. By the way, I literally will see curse words used by founders describing the first version of their site. Sometimes people think that I'm being hard on their site. I'm just reading my notes from the conversation that they had with our producer about how bad their site looked. You're smiling as you're looking at this. Am I right?
Yeah. But did you see the logo though?
Yeah, the logo does need, I don't fully get it. There's like what is the logo? With a gem underneath the T?
Is this the first one? Oh no, that's the second logo.
It's like water tap almost, but it's not. It doesn't look like a water tap. It looks like a pogo stick.
Yeah. Now that's the one created by an intern we got at some point. But
and then the first one was this pair of water. It's not terrible, really. Believe me, it's not terrible.
This is already the improved version. Maybe
you got the bad one. Hi, but frankly, if your logo is, what was it?
Yeah, it was basically a tap with a drop coming from it. So the idea was sort of like tap into affiliate marketing today. What we learned during the printing era is that that affiliate marketing gave us a sort of like undercurrent of, you know, profit, like a base profit that would come in. So that's the water team. So that's where that came from.
I always thought TAP was you were thinking ahead that we're going to be in not a click-based world like DoubleClick was in, but a tap-based world, which is the TAP device. Look what I'm holding this on, an iPad, right? Yeah. I thought, no, I get it now. All right, but here's the other thing that I noticed. You could have easily said, we're going to take a share of commissions, right? You're going to pay your affiliates. We're going to get a piece of that. You don't get paid until you get paid. Instead, you decided, we're just going to get paid a monthly fee, regardless of your commissions, just for everything that we track, right? Here, there's the sales structure.
Definitely.
Kind of badly put up on the screen because I'm holding up the iPad to the camera. But
it worked.
But that's what it was, right? That was you saying, I need consistency. I can't have the ups and downs of a business, right?
Yeah, well, that also, but this is more of a, you know, a philosophical standpoint I have on affiliate marketing. I think, you know, there's a place for businesses to take part of the commission, but the sort of like the kind of affiliate marketing that we try to encourage, where there's, you know, really it's you, the partner, and no one in between, where you get, like, as an advertiser, full control. I don't think that would be, boosted if we were taking parts of the profit. I think, you know, it's if you do it yourself and work directly with the partner, you can actually use that extra money that you're saving, not paying as a network commission, because that's normally what happens with networks. It's something that you can give to the partner or you can share. So you can create a more enticing deal for those affiliates.
Right. If I don't have to pay you that money, I can pay to my affiliates and then they're more likely to send me more customers. And frankly, the rest of my stack doesn't work that way. I don't have to pay HostGator more every time I make a sale, right? They just get paid for hosting. And that's partially what went into this. You took a couple of months to build it. You built it yourself, the first version?
Yeah. Still most of it.
To this day, still most of it?
Well, I think like most of the platform is built by me. Yeah, we're four developers now. But, you know, to be honest, in the end, I like being an entrepreneur, but, you know, I love being a developer a little bit more sometimes. So I still am very, you know, involved with product development and also coding, because it's just, it's also my hobby.
You launched it on a beta list, which was created by Mixergy Fan, someone who I interviewed. Great site to go and find new products. How did you do on beta list?
Yeah, pretty well. Like, I was really? So surprised. I was so surprised, to be honest. Yeah, I remember the excitement. I went to a soccer match of Ajax. I think it was the day that it was launched. And I remember, like, sitting up in the stadium and getting, like, my first customer support emails. And it was like, I remember, like, that feeling. It was so good. You know, people are actually interacting with the product. There's stuff is happening. I really hadn't expected it to go that fast. And, you know, we got a couple of hundred subscribers on the first day, I think.
And you were already charging.
No. This is beta list. Yeah, I think that's the spirit of beta list. Is, you know, you can try it for free in exchange for feedback.
I thought you had a $29 price point right from the start. I guess not.
After like 3 months, I think. I think we launched the beta somewhere in January, and then the first paying customer we had on April, somewhere in April.
Was it the same free people who you were able to convert into paid?
I don't think so. No, I remember that sort of like that customer. I think we had like $10 a day AdWords budget, or something like that. And I think we got a customer from there. And I remember like being really surprised, like refreshing the page, seeing one customer. I was actually surprised back then.
I'm seeing your listing on beta list right now. Was invites one of your thing that you were giving people free invites or something? Was that part of how you hooked them in?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's nice. You create some, you don't want to get overwhelmed in the beginning, but you also want to, you know, it creates some sense of urgency for people, you know, wanting to sign up. So I think that's a nice way of doing it.
And so you kept going with that. And then at some point you went to Facebook and Google AdWords. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, all sales up to this day is automated. It's only, you know, online advertising. We don't pick up the phone to do any outbound calling. And as a result, or as part of that, we've worked a lot on, you know, making the whole process like really automated and hands off, and just trying to optimize to get people to use product without, you know, needing our help. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's something that we've, you know, been always working on really, really hard. And that's why I think we can also continue up to this day to do only automated sales.
I feel like that's an advantage of yours, but it's also a big challenge of yours, that you're kind of missing out on the customers who have more to spend, but they want to do a demo and you don't do a demo. They want a little bit more handholding and you don't do that, right?
Yeah, that's just not our positioning. I think, you know, our product, you know, allows you to do everything yourself. It just works for a lot of people. It works for us, for our business model.
And then how did you figure out how to do AdWords and Facebook? It's a competitive market. I don't think it was as competitive back in 2014 when you were doing it, but still wasn't easy. And you're not someone who has that background.
No. Okay. So, well, I think like any keywords surrounding affiliate marketing are pretty competitive. Of course, not as competitive as it is now. But yeah, you know, we were bootstrapped. So everything that we had to do in the company, especially in the beginning, I had to do, because, you know, I put in just a little bit of money, like maybe like $15,000 or $20,000 in the beginning. And build it from there. So we had to do cost cutting wherever possible. And that meant that I had to do everything. So I taught myself how to do AdWords. And there's more examples
of me doing things. By buying ads and failing? Or was there something that you did?
No, I think I just read up on it a lot, came up with a strategy. You know, I think the strategy was to be very, very tight in how we did the keywords. So everything was, only exact matches in the beginning. So we knew we get like very, very high targeted traffic, but just a little bit. And that turned out to work. And I think that's the game, you know, if you do AdWords, it might be different these days. I haven't bothered with it in a while. But the game was always, you know, you go in very narrow, and then you widen up a bit, so your spending increase, but your conversions also increase, but your trial to paying ratio might decrease a little bit. And it's sort of like that game with the little metrics, you know, with the metrics, and you know, they're all communicating, of course, and just keeping everything in check and slowly like growing the thing.
I'm looking now to see what keywords are sending you traffic. Why is like, oh, here, Tapfiliate is a big one. Let me see, affiliate marketing is another one. Best WordPress plugin for affiliate marketers. That's another one that you're using, right? That you're buying ads for.
That's I'm not the one doing it, but that sounds correct. We do have a WordPress and WooCommerce plugin. So
yeah, I saw you got, from what I remember, good ratings in the in their plugin marketplace. What about John Cristani course? Who's John Cristani?
Is he
someone you're working with?
I don't know.
No, you're getting traffic from that. All right. So I'm kind of hunting down to see how much of your traffic is now coming from search. And it's a pretty big number. We're looking at like 14%, not huge, right?
Are you talking about paid ads?
It's mostly organic. 64% organic, 36% paid, roughly, right? That's where you guys are there.
Yeah, sounds about right.
But then I'm trying to figure out, are you using affiliate marketing to promote your affiliate program? But you know what? Let me take a moment, talk about my second sponsor, and then come back in. My second sponsor is a company called ClickFunnels. What they usually do is create landing pages. What they want me to talk about is the fact that they have a new podcast that everyone who's listening to me, especially if they're into online marketing, is going to want to listen to. You guys don't connect directly in with ClickFunnels, Thomas. Do you want to say something about what you would be able to do if ClickFunnels directly plugged into you? Let's make a pitch to Russell Brunson, who in his book, Traffic Secrets, said that this is his favorite business podcast, or his favorite podcast in general. If he plugged in directly, what would his customers get, and what's the functionality that we'd all have?
Oh, what a nice opportunity. So basically, we can connect ClickFunnels. What we could do, we get a lot of their customers who, you know, ask us, you know, can we connect ClickFunnels? And unfortunately, we always have to say no. But what we could do is, you know, help them grow their landing pages that they create with ClickFunnels, help them grow it through affiliate marketing. And the nice thing is I know that ClickFunnels works with Stripe, with whom we have a direct integration. So, you know, if you get like a dispute or a refund, that's automatically taken care of. If you do recurring commissions, that can also be automatically taken care of just by connecting your Stripe account. And the only thing, if we want to connect with ClickFunnels, that we need from them is for them to be able to give us either the Stripe customer ID or the Stripe charge ID, preferably the customer ID, so that we can use that when we track the customer to the affiliate. And from there, the rest is all automated.
And that's the way you work. And you guys do the, who reaches out to partners like ClickFunnels? I wonder if they even know that they should be connecting with you. Is that you?
I did that, but it has been years ago, to be honest. You know, and we keep an eye on it with ClickFunnels, especially because we have so many of them. You know,
contact. Do you have a partnership person on board, or is it still?
Yeah, that would be me. Yeah,
that's. I got to ask you about that when we get back into the interview. About like how you've taken on so much still, even though you backed off, it's still a you company. All right, so ClickFunnels, great company. I use their landing pages. I can understand why they would want to plug in with Tapfiliate. I've got to tell you guys, they've got a podcast that if you're into marketing, you should be listening to. Here's why. This is a company that is doing over $100 million a year in sales, all in the marketing software space. That means their customers are doing marketing, and that's why they sign up for their software. That means that ClickFunnels is fantastic at doing marketing themselves, or else you wouldn't see so many people signing up to their software. So they know marketing. And what Russell Brunson, the founder, is amazing at is storytelling. I sometimes wonder if he's in the company doing anything other than telling stories internally and maybe coming up with crazy great ideas that he convinces everyone to jump on. But all he does is teach using stories internally, externally. And he's got this podcast that if you hate marketing, you're going to love because he's such a good storyteller. If you love marketing, you're going to love because it's like candy for the brain, the way that he tells it. And there's nothing for you to sign up for and pay for it. There's nothing for you to pay for. There is something for you to sign up for. Whatever podcast app you're listening to me on, stop what you're doing and go subscribe to Traffic Secrets right now. When you do, you're going to get this guy, Russell Brunson, who's a great storyteller, teaching you through stories how you can do things like buy better Google ads, do better Facebook marketing, how you can get traffic from Instagram, all this stuff. And some of it is not just broad social platforms and tech platforms. Some of it is just like the one-on-one stuff that he does to convince people to partner up with him so that he can grow his business. He'll teach you what's working for him and his customers. All you have to do is sign up to the free podcast. It's called Traffic Secrets. It's the underground playbook for filling your website and funnels with your dream customers. Really, that is not an exaggeration. Go check out Traffic Secrets. Great podcast. Do you do a lot of affiliate marketing yourself? I'm not seeing that.
Yeah, we definitely do. Yeah, of course. Yeah, we do a sort of affiliate inception where we use our own product to run an affiliate program for our own product. And that's definitely one of our bigger channels.
How are you getting affiliates? Who are your affiliates? I'm obviously spying on your traffic, spying on your site, and I see something called Sprizzy that seems to have some kind of partnership with you, but I don't have enough insight just by doing this. Can you tell me what's working for you as an affiliate?
Yeah, manager? Yeah, so we do many different things. We run several programs. I think that's also one of the things that our software does, that it's you can run like several programs. So we run side by side a referral program and an affiliate program. Referral program is something we do with our existing customers. So we ask them to promote the product and they can earn cash or discounts. But we also do an affiliate program. And for the affiliate program, like we really reached out to just bloggers and websites that are interesting to us. We scouted those out, reached out to them, and onboarded them on our affiliate program. So for example, for us, there's a lot of websites, great websites that write about WordPress plugins or WooCommerce plugins. And those are, you know, really good affiliates for us because our product works one-on-one. Their traffic, like everybody interested in WooCommerce is a potential customer for us. So those are just, you know, really, really great deals.
And is this you reaching out to them one-on-one, you personally?
No. This is we had an affiliate manager for a while, but he unfortunately was an affiliate marketer manager specialized in SaaS. So that was really good. But now our marketing team does.
Now who's doing it?
The marketing department.
Oh, got it. Okay. So let's talk about what I hinted at earlier, which is that you're somebody who was taking on way too much, right? At one point? What was that like? What were you taking on that was excessive?
Yeah, so it was, you know, born out of necessity in the first place because the company was bootstrapped. So you just can't go around and, you know, get an accountant at, I don't know, what is it, like $600 a month? Because, you know, that was our budget would be gone within a couple of months. So for example, you know, we couldn't pay for an accountant or a bookkeeping system. So I built a bookkeeping system myself in the beginning. Also because I was interested in, you know, how bookkeeping worked and I knew some of it, you know, from studying. But the first 2 years we ran on our own the bookkeeping system that I built. And I did the bookkeeping as well, for instance.
So instead of using QuickBooks or one of the other platforms, you built it yourself.
Yeah. Well, you can't really use QuickBooks in the Netherlands. I think maybe you can now. But back then, you know, you need something that is compliant with Dutch tax laws and can let you do your taxes, basically. And the other thing is that one mistake I think that we made early on or that I made is that we went on to use Stripe and then later added PayPal. And I also built a billing system ourselves. So, you know, it did all the subscriptions and all that logic. And then it did the charging both through PayPal and Stripe. And that meant that we couldn't get, you know, a nice generic solution. Later, I learned that Stripe already had all this with Stripe subscriptions. But I had to build something that could do the reconciliation of all the charges versus all the of all the bookkeeping entries that we made. And there was no product to do that because we had these two different payment platforms. So, that also sort of like made it necessary to do this.
And so when it got to be excessive, what happened to you or your company that made you realize this is too much? I got to stop.
Yeah, there was a combination of things. So first of all, you know, it took a while to get the company started. We had like 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 customers. You know, it was growing really, really slowly. At least it was not enough for me to pay myself. Then there was this other partner who was also, you know, looking to get paid at some point, of course. And that was, you know, without me knowing it actually, turned out to be weighing pretty heavily on me. Then next to that, I always got an email whenever someone canceled. And that was just like tiny little steps. And I remember like I was, my partner was away on his honeymoon, and I was in our office. I got one of those anti-squatting office spaces. obviously. And I remember like sitting there and I got like three of those cancellation emails and I just like lost it. And I just went berserk. I remember. And actually, a guy who has now become my partner really recently. In the company, as a partner in the company, was sitting there. He was working on another company back then, and he just sent me that, like, "What's up? Like, are you okay?" And then, you know, I spoke with him for a little bit, and he says, "Dude, I think you know you're just very stressed." I said, "Well, you're right." And the weird thing is, I had gone to the doctors the week before because I had like all these tremors and everything, and I was feeling really, really weird. And the doctor asked me, like, "Are you stressed?" And I said, well, I was thinking, I said, well, I'm not stressed because I only knew stress as the being late kind of stress, you know, missing your flight kind of stress, like that feeling. But I learned then that there is a really different kind of stress, and that's subconscious stress. That's where, you know, you get all these tiny steps and everything. So he told me, man, I think you're just really stressed. And I sat down and I opened the text file, of course, in my IDE as a developer. And I just wrote down, I'm stressed. And I just started, you know, writing down like everything that was bothering me. One of the things was, well, I'm digging into my savings. it doesn't look like I'm going to get paid anytime soon. If that partner of mine needs to get paid, that's going to make things like twice as hard. And the fourth thing that I wrote down is like, and nobody knows I feel this way. So I first went home. Yeah. So first went home to my wife, told her how it felt. Then I called, I have another sort of like silent partner in the company, is more of an advisor who has a stake in the company, a very experienced ex-McKinsey kind of person. I called him and told him, this is not going well. So we met in the park, sat on a bench and talked for hours. And I always felt like, people who this happens to, like I always saw that as a sort of like weak thing. And then this man who I have in really, really high regard, he told me he went through the exact same thing. And what I learned is that it's more of a thing that will happen to people who are, very driven, take on a lot of, take on a lot. And then it sort of like happens. But we sat on a bench and, he was just very practical. He said, well, okay, so what you're going to do, you're going to tell your partner he's not getting paid. You are the company. So without you, it's not going to happen. So he's just not getting paid. It's as simple as that. You're going to spend less on AdWords. You're going to do this and this. And you're going to pay yourself tomorrow. So I did all those things. And I also, took care of all the other things that I wrote down. And that sort of like solved it for me really, really quickly. But it was not a good time.
When was this?
I'd have to look it up.
But roughly, we're talking a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and well, I think 2016, something like that.
And are you taking more time now?
15, 16.
Does a company work well with, let me ask you this. If you had a worst case of COVID, if for some reason you were out for 2 months where you couldn't touch a keyboard, would the company continue to do well?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, actually, we, the past few years, we have spent, a tremendous amount of effort on making me unnecessary. Which is really nice, because, we've documented everything internally. We've automated everything. Back in the day, I used to have to go into the database to do things. But now I can just, mostly work on the things I like, partnerships and also working on products. So, no, definitely the company would definitely survive. I remember I remember my honeymoon. That was the first time, and this was in 2017, that I could go for 3 weeks without doing anything.
Huh. Yeah. And now at night when you're having dinner with your wife, are you checking your phone all the time? Are you the type of person who needs to keep staying involved?
Yeah, to be honest, a little bit. Yeah. But I'm just, I don't know. I'm just someone, who does one thing, like hyper-focuses on it. And then, at some point moves on to the next thing. But, I'm always involved with what I do. I don't really believe in the separation of work and life. And I don't know. I think you just have to make sure that whatever you do is really, really fun. And then it all becomes entangled in a good way.
I've seen a lot of that here in San Francisco. I don't think I could talk about the people who I've seen at like family barbecues who are on their phone the whole time, like dads who are, they pay attention to their kids, but for the most part, I can think of a few who are on the phone the whole time, who will step back if we're going for a hike. And you know, it's not because they're slow. It's because they're sneaking in their phone. They're way worse than you. The one person who I remember who's doing this kind of like in a normal way, and he'd be okay with me bringing it up, is Justin, the founder of Needles. He'd have his phone on a table when we're having a drink, and he gets alerts every time an email comes in. I said, can't you just let the emails go? He goes, I can't go to sleep with even one unread message and unresponded to message in my inbox. Are you someone who has alerts even for text messages and for emails? No, you're not at that point anymore.
No. But I do check in, sort of like. But yeah, I'm not someone who's on the phone all the time. I think that, it can be like a little rude for us. And it's also, it's hard sometimes, obviously, because you want to know what's going on and you want to, make sure everything's okay. And it always is, most of the time. But I don't know. Yeah.
But you don't have to be there all the time. The reason that I say that is because we've exchanged a few emails. And you're one of the fastest people to respond to a message. The one time that you weren't responding fast was we were supposed to be doing an interview here and I couldn't freaking connect. I couldn't make the interview happen. This was last Wednesday. It was such a terrible way for me to start my day without being able to connect with you. So I emailed you and then a little bit later you emailed me back and you said, I was just sitting here on camera and I turned off email. So I wasn't able to respond. I said, this guy's even fast when he's slow. COVID, let me close out with this. Are sales up this year relative to last year, say April, May, maybe even March, are they higher than they were last year?
We had increased churn in February and March, or March and April, I think. But it's really hard to say. We started out in February with a new marketing agency. We used a couple ones here in the Netherlands and now have, for the first time, a company from the U.S., and they are rocking it, you know, but they already did that before COVID started. So, you know, it's really hard to say, it's really hard to gauge, you know, what's due to what. Also, because, you know, we made so many like great changes also for the product recently, and that's helping out a lot. So, yeah, there's a lot
What's the percentage increase in sales this year versus last year?
I think it's about,
roughly
like 30%. Okay.
Yeah, I know we're not getting to like account level accuracy. I just want to get a sense of it. Are we talking about 3x or are we talking just 3%? This gives me a sense of where you are.
Like 30%.
30. And it's not necessarily even related to COVID and people creating more. It's possible that some of that is happening for you. Am I right? But it's also possible. Yeah.
Yeah. We see, you know, everyone in travel is, you know, leaving, of course, because, you know, they have to do real hard cost cutting. We also see a lot of people moving things online, businesses that were already in the process. I also think that, you know, personally, of course, I'd say this, but I really do think that affiliate marketing is, you know, a great way it's a good marketing channel in these times because, you know, it fosters, it works by having good relationships and, I think that's a good thing in this time.
Yeah, the beauty of affiliate marketing has always been you need an ad, you don't have to ask permission, you don't have to convince anyone, you don't have to prove anything to anyone, you just go get the link. Well, you do have to prove that you're a legitimate person worth working with.
Yeah.
Definitely. You can get the link and then put it up on your site and then see if how it does. But you don't have to convince them that you're worth spending money on. I remember reading a book about the early days of Google when they were trying to figure out whether AdWords even made sense. They just grabbed an affiliate program. In their case, it was the Amazon affiliate program, right? And they could just stick a bunch of products in there just to get a sense of whether it's working or not. I think for many people, affiliate ads are the first and best way to get started in any kind of advertising, right? You just go get an affiliate program link from someone whose product you trust, promote it in a way that's more personal than if you were just running, I wouldn't say banner, those are dead, but if you were running any kind of regular ad, and then see how it does. What's overall revenue?
We're north of $1.5 million this year.
Profitable?
Yeah, since the second year, actually.
How many people on the team?
We're nine.
Nine people. So less than 10% profit, right? Net profit?
It's
10% net profit.
Way higher.
Net, not gross. At the end of the day, you get to keep more than 20%?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So you guys are really doing well then. I mean, you're a stable company, good growth. Beautiful product, just really beautiful. You know what kind of a jerk I am? And this is the thing I've got to watch out, that it's because I'm podcasting that so many people fling offers at me. I'm the greatest. You should interview me. And so I've become skeptical. I just go hunt down the negativity to see what did I miss. I don't want to be like these podcasters. I swear I would never name them, but I could see they feature people who I know have nothing. They're just absolute fakers. And at some point that's going to happen to me if it didn't already. I'm not saying that I'm invincible here, but I am saying I'm paranoid about it. So what I did was I went online and I started just seeing Tapfiliate. What are the negative things that people say about Tapfiliate? What can I see? And the first thing I think I saw was like a Capterra rating. It's like, all right, Capterra. 4.6 rating, 31 reviews. I go, all right, everyone can fudge Capterra. Let me keep going down in. So then I go a little bit further. WordPress, 5-star review. But all right, it's only 4 people. Let's see who else. And I'm just like hunting you down. What are they saying on Product Hunt? They're kind of jerk. Nah, they're nice on Product Hunt, but they could be a little bit critical. you're not on Product Hunt, so I couldn't see you there, but you are on other platforms like GetApp. And anyway, so I saw, it's not just me saying this is a beautiful product. It's your users who are saying it. It's other people who are saying it. You know where I wasn't able to find you? Reddit. That's where I find the, like, the dirt on people, where like people get angry for nothing. It's like, damn Disney, why do they have to show their logo before every movie? Don't they know that I got time and I don't have much time. I have places to go. You know, like, they'll complain about anything. I couldn't find you in there. It actually, I think auto, unless I misdid it there. And what was the other one? The big affiliate forum, Warrior Forum. I couldn't find you in there. You're not in there.
No, that's right.
You might be. I just couldn't find you. They auto corrected it to from Tapfiliate to Affiliate, and then God knows that's going to bring up a bunch of other stuff. Let me try to put it in quotes. Let me see. Maybe I can come up with some negative stuff here.
Yeah. No, there should definitely be some hits there.
There's got to be some negativity out there. But anyway, for the most part, I'm seeing that people love the software, you're doing well as a company, and you survived COVID. Do you feel good about that?
Yeah, definitely. But I also, you know, keep thinking about, you know, first of all these people losing other people. And then, you know, I just spoke with a friend of mine today. He has like two like beautiful restaurants here in Amsterdam. And he just had to decide to close one today, which is really, really sad because it was his first location. So, you know, it's also entrepreneurs getting hit by this. So there's so much misery in it. So I'm happy I'm healthy, but my thoughts are actually more with other people, I guess.
There's a New York Times article today saying people who have survived, this one was people who survived COVID are being shunned by others for some reason. I don't know why. The previous sets of weird articles that they had were about people being feeling guilty for surviving it, for doing well. Like, I got past it, now I feel guilty. And
business wise, I recognize that. You know, we're doing well at this point. But you know, you don't know what's coming. You know, there is very good chances that we'll have an epic recession. So I don't know how I'll be doing in a couple of months, or how we'll be doing. Of course, nobody knows. But then there's, you know, friends that whose businesses are going bankrupt. You know,
right.
Yeah, of course you feel bad about that. So I wouldn't call it shame, but yeah. It's normally you can be very proud of being, you know, of the successes you're having. This is just not the time for that.
I do see that. When I went out on Twitter and I said, is anyone doing well? I did get quite a few people who said, I'm doing well, but I just don't feel comfortable saying it because I don't want people to think I'm dancing while everyone else is dying. And I understood that at first, and I didn't push, and I'll never push. But what I'm recognizing is that there is, forget the economic depression, I think there is a psychic depression among entrepreneurs, this sense of futility. And I'm not talking like about other people. I'm saying I feel it too. I think we're all feeling it to some degree, the sense of what's going to happen? What's going to happen to me? This is awful. I just lost out on this thing. If it could only have gone on for just, if the economy could have only grown for one more year, then I would have been even better, right? We feel all that. And it's really painful. I think it's helpful for our psyches. It's helpful for our psychological well-being to hear positive stories because, frankly, people are counting on us to lead. My kids are counting on me to figure out where they're going to go to school next year and where they're going to live, right? They can't have me moping around the house. The people I work with are counting on me having energy to keep guiding them and to keep making tough decisions. The people I interview, the people who are customers of mine, right? It's all on us. And I can't just bring it out of thin air. I got to have it from other people and then channel it for my people, for my family, for my work. And you being on here is helping me channel you. And I appreciate that. And I know that that's what's happening to others. I know that if they allow themselves to just feel that there's some good stuff going on in the world and that they look for it themselves, that they're going to be in a better situation for doing it. Thomas, thanks so much for being on here and being a part of this mission.
Yeah, thank you very much, Andrew.
The website is tapfiliate.com. Go check them out or do what I did. Just like put them into Google and see what other people are saying about them. I think you'll be very happy. And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first is HostGator, where I went and signed up and created a brand new business for my man, Drew, from the zoo. He is furloughed from the San Diego Zoo. I think he's doing maybe a few hours a week for them, doing some remote Zoom stuff for them. But for the rest of the time, he's doing nothing. And so he now has a little side business where he's able to teach kids about insects and animals and psych them up and give parents maybe like an hour of quiet time where they could just sit and take a breath in the middle of the day. HostGator allowed me to do it because I went to HostGator.com/Mixergy, and I urge you to go play with your new HostGator account. Set it up and then play with it. And second, now that this interview is over, go check out Traffic Secrets Podcast. I'm not going to say anything. I'm going to end this with two words. The podcast you should go and subscribe to now that it's over, Traffic Secrets.